This is Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories. I'm Sarah Reith, and we are at Mary Buckley's house on June 25th. Can you introduce yourself?
I'm Mary Buckley. I've lived in Mendocino County since 1981 and raised my kids out in the hills outside Ukiah.
Where were you before you came to Mendocino County, and what brought you here?
Well, I grew up in Chicago, and as long as I could remember, I couldn't wait to get out of the city. So I was still in college, my last year of college actually, in Oxford. And a friend from college was teaching Mariposa School, Jonathan Conant. We called him Jay in college. And he wrote to us in England and said, "Oh, you should check it out. Ukiah has a co-op now and everything." And we were pretty young and said, "Okay, let's go." So after college, we returned to Chicago and made some money. I was doing computer programming and documentation, and bought a bus and visited everybody we knew between Chicago and California, and ended up here.
What were you expecting to find?
I think mostly what I wanted, I had a vague concept because I really had never been here and didn't really know what I was getting into at all, much like most things in life. I just wanted my kids to grow up someplace different from the city. I grew up in the 60s on the south side of Chicago, and it was actually a dangerous time and place, racial tensions and riots and crime, and it was dirty and dangerous. Chicago is actually nicer now than it was when I left, but I wanted some place that was peaceful, safe, clean, beautiful, healthy. To raise kids was the main thing I was thinking.
How old were your kids?
One of them was born in Potter Valley at home in 1982. The other one was born in Chicago in 1979. So we moved to California when she was two, just barely two.
Can you talk about the community that you ended up settling down in here in Mendocino County?
Well, it took a couple of years to find what became my home at Stone's Throw, a community outside Ukiah, during which time I met quite a few people, enough to be invited to stay there when I came back after traveling for a while.
So we looked at some pictures, and there's one from a mortgage burning party. So was this a communally held property, or what was the community like at Stone's Throw?
Originally it was a house and 68 acres. The house was probably from World War II era, when all the young couples were settling down and building places. And somebody said it might go as far back as the 20s. And then John Milder was the person who came out there with a little bundle of money that he'd made in the city and started inviting people to come live there and build places. And this was in the 70s. And my house was built in what became my house was built in probably 77 or so. And it was just a hexagon with a couple of rooms tacked onto it by whoever came along with some creative ideas. And like most hand-built houses, there was hardly a right angle in the whole place, and carpenters would always complain when they worked on it. But the community was mostly based on what we shared was wanting a good place for our kids, so it was very compatible that way. I don't know if you'd call it intentional community in any other sense, but just that we wanted a nice place to raise kids, and we wanted to share what resources we had, you know, free box and diapers and child care and work parties and potluck dinners and rides to town and, you know, jump start the car if you need it and that kind of thing. I could never have raised my kids by myself as a single mom out in the hills, you know, in the woods, just us. That it just wouldn't have worked. But with six families on the land, and we were all in sort of the same stage too. Several of the kids were born there, and most of them were roughly the same age, and they were maybe 10 or 12 when they were all there, which they usually weren't all at once, but there was always a pack of kids around, so I knew the kids were fine. They'd just go out to play, and I knew they'd find each other, and they'd maybe stop by for, I had six or eight kids for lunch, and then they'd disappear again, or they'd hang out in our house for a while, and we knew they were taken care of and safe, and that the other adults were not far away. There were about five of the six houses were on just a few acres worth, so they were close enough to like see the other houses through the trees and for little kids to walk back and forth. One of them was a little further out at the edge of the property, but it was really a pretty perfect little village for sharing child raising, as it turned out.
Can you describe the house in more detail? We were looking at pictures and I just kept thinking that it looked like a tree house or like a storybook house.
Well, it has a very sweet location on a south-facing hillside, and there's a lot of madrone trees around the house, and Douglas fir and oak. And it was originally just a hexagon, maybe, I don't know, 15 or 20 feet across, and with a loft, and that was it. It was a one-person house. And then someone else came along and took off the four French doors that were two of the walls of the hexagon, and added on a kind of a triangular-shaped room, roughly shaped, just kind of poking out into the trees where the hill sloped away, so you felt like you're kind of up in the air. And he turned those French doors sideways so that they could open out, and then put another row of windows above them, which I eventually actually put glass into. When I moved there, it was stapled up glass, and one of the windows was denim, and another was a tarp, you know, just bits, and there were some trees growing through the house. They hadn't wanted to take out the madrones, and they are such special and beautiful trees. I don't blame them, except that eventually I had to take them out because they were, you know, pressing up against the house and inviting aphids and leaking around the edges and just not very happy. I wouldn't recommend building a house around a tree, but they did call it the tree house, partly for that reason and partly because the what I used as the bedroom, you know, the main room with all the windows, I had a bed built into that triangular corner, and it felt like you were kind of up in the air in the trees, and very sweet. When I first moved there, it hadn't really been maintained or developed much. There was no hot water. There was one cold water tap. There was no privy. I had to dig a hole down the hill a little ways. And eventually I designed and built on a privy and built on a deck and replaced the roof. But the first winter there was an awful lot of leaks, and it was, you know, I'd find books molding away, or a towel I'd put on a shelf suddenly, you know, moldy spot underneath it, and I had to throw away a lot of stuff. Not that he had a lot of stuff. We started out pretty minimalist and kind of kept it that way. But the house, I just loved it so much. The hexagon had a point with, you know, pointed roof with skylights, and one skylight where you could actually poke your head out, and the kids loved that. They'd climb up in the loft and poke your head out the little loft window and yell to your friends down the through the trees. And as I said, we did have to eventually take out the trees that were growing through the house, but it still had that feeling of kind of growing there in place. And there's a third room. It was pretty funky. I took most of it apart before rebuilding it, and it's still kind of an odd shape. You can imagine a triangle and a hexagon stuck together, and the other room was kind of what was left. And I did quite a bit of work on it over the years, little bits and pieces, and just made it our own.
So how did you make it work financially?
Well, I was pretty independent-minded, and I did not want to be on welfare, even though I was, you know, a single mom with two little kids. I decided I'm going to just work and barter and do what I have to do to make it work, and a large part of that was just not spending much money. My first year or so there, I bartered for my rent, which was $100 a month, and we bought it about 2 years later. And we're all panicked, like, oh no, where are six families going to come up with $140,000 to buy this property? So my share was $23,000, and it seemed astronomical. I couldn't imagine. But I was working the whole time. I think the first 6 months I was kind of coasting on just trading for various, you know, babysitting and that kind of thing. That was how I paid the rent the first few months. And when I finally realized I needed breaks, because we had to drive to town. I'd go to town once a week to do laundry and shopping. And it was a dirt road. It's almost exactly half an hour drive from State Street and Logap. And it's a fair amount of dirt road driving. And eventually I realized, oh no, $150 for breaks. What am I going to do? So I got a couple of jobs. I worked as an acupuncture assistant for Dr. Grace Liu at the acupuncture clinic. And I worked one day a week at the hospital on the computer there, just helping them catch up with the weekend entries. And in those days, you know, they didn't have, you know, barcodes to scan or anything like that. It had to be entered manually. So I was working a couple of jobs, and then I added on another day a week when a neighbor, John Takis, who was installing solar electric systems, put in my little tiny solar electric system for my cabin. He didn't want me to pay him back. He was a very generous guy. And I said, no, I have to pay you back. But I was giving him garden baskets because I was growing lots of vegetables. And I realized it would take a long time to, you know, pay off $1,000, like, again, really astronomical sum. And his partner, Pat Lawrence, said, well, you've worked in bookkeeping on offices before, and they also had a bookkeeping and tax preparation service, and I worked for them, and I liked them a lot, so I worked with them for a couple of years and became a tax preparer, actually, during that time. And then they sold the business and moved to the coast, but meanwhile, I had my little electric system, and then I started working for New Dimensions Radio after they moved, and that became my main job for quite a while. It was very interesting material to work with, and I worked with the interviews and transcribing them and editing them and that kind of thing. And then eventually I started some of my own businesses of doing various things. I was a acupressure therapist for a while, massage and acupressure, and I became a feng shui consultant and teacher. And I've been editing, freelance book editing, for a while. So I think our main way of making it work financially was just not to spend money. I remember every once in a while a catalog would arrive in the mailbox, and I would just put it in recycling before even looking at it. And just not, you know, just having a free box and making our own stuff and keeping it simple, you know, expense-wise, if not otherwise.
So you were talking a little bit about the things that you made. Can you talk about some of the homesteading skills that you acquired while you were out there?
I was pretty much a city girl when I arrived. I don't know if I had much in the way of skills. My younger daughter's father was highly skilled and had taught me lots of various tricks and things about carpentry and plumbing. And eventually I learned some electricity, and I talked to a guy at the phone company who told me how to install a phone jack myself. And my carpentry never did get beyond a pretty basic level, but again, I just did what I could in terms of bartering with people to get things fixed and scrounging materials. For a while I did hand spinning from the wool on the sheep to the finished products, and I sold some of those, although the first time I started selling them, I realized, you know what, it is fun to do, but if I start doing this for money, it's not going to be fun anymore. So I decided this is not going to be my profession. Big revelation. Oh, now it's an order instead of an art piece. So I decided not to pursue that too much. I had studied gardening a lot as a teenager in Chicago. I thought it sounded so magical to grow my own food. I just couldn't imagine anything more wonderful than that. So I subscribed to organic gardening when I was 13 years old and read all those Rodale publications. And then I actually lived my first summer in California, lived at Camp Joy outside of Santa Cruz, Boulder Creek, which was Alan Chadwick's students. He was the guy that brought biodynamic farming to this area. And John Jevons was a student of his, and or colleague or whatever he call it, and learned a few more techniques in milking goats and taking care of chickens. And we didn't have goats and chickens at Stone's Throw on the property. I didn't anyway. Some of the neighbors had some chickens, but learned how to do that and just started gardening, and mostly learned by trial and error.
What about other kinds of ways of getting food together?
Oh, yes. Did lots of canning. I loved that. I wish I had a better picture of all those colors, the jars. I just loved lining them up on the shelves and admiring them, you know, the tomato colors and the plum colors and blackberries and apples and pears. And oh, I just loved doing that. And just, I don't remember how I learned. I probably just read some instructions and books and something. I made my own soap and lotions and lip balm and things like that.
There are some great pictures of your kids, like one of them is very studiously hammering a nail when she's about 4 years old. So what kinds of skills did your kids get from the experience?
Well, it's funny, my older daughter is more of a city girl. She's a doctor in the Bay Area, and the younger one is living in London at the moment, although she's coming back to California having just had her second baby. They didn't really, when I think back, I think one thing I regret was that I didn't play with them more. I would have liked to do more music, for instance, and just play. I was working so hard, you know, doing three jobs and a big garden and just keeping the household together and taking care of the kids. I was so serious and so hardworking that we did have, of course, we sang together and we did have some fun times and fun outings and things like that. But I don't remember teaching them much. It was mostly like, just go play and I'll do what I do. And they did pick up some gardening. But one of them, the older one, really wants to be in the city. She's really not that interested. They both do some gardening, but she's not going to want a homestead or anything like that. The younger one said she'd love to live there again, but her life has been elsewhere for a long time, so who knows. I think probably that picture was taken when I was having some carpentry done around the house, whether I was doing it myself or having somebody working on it, which happened a lot. So there were probably just hammers and nails lying around and some boards, and she discovered the joy of hammering nails into boards, and she would do these, a whole board full of nails, and then she would zigzag string between the nails and make little musical instruments or little games or little art pieces or something like that. Yeah, I can't say that there was a whole lot of skill going on, mine or theirs, but we got by.
There were also some kids that were born on the community, and you assisted in that. Can you talk about that experience?
Some of the kids were born there, and one of them I delivered, not because I had any particular background or skill. Again, I think it was more a matter of youth and ignorance and boldness than anything. It wasn't like, oh, this is a good idea, let's do it because we're doing it the right way. It was more like, oh, okay, well, let's see what happens and let's try it. This woman, during the period just before I moved there, we were traveling, and I lived at a hot springs near Mount Shasta for a while. And my younger daughter was about 6 months old when this couple arrived, just kind of gypsying around, and 7 months pregnant, I think, at the time. And within a couple months, they had their baby, and I helped deliver it because I had just had a baby and had read lots of books and, you know, knew a little bit about it, which of course is a dangerous thing, but luckily she was young and healthy and it all went smoothly. And then she sought me out a couple years later, but by that time I was living at Stone's Throw. And I think she and her husband, 9 months pregnant, just came to the co-op and started asking around, there's this place called Stone's Throw, does anybody know Mary? So they actually found me, and I was in Chicago at the time visiting my sister, and she and her husband and a couple of her kids and a couple of my kids, I don't remember how many we had at that time, but we all drove across country in a big station wagon, camping along the way just for fun because we hadn't done that before. And we arrived, we were met by one of the neighbors near the front gate, and he said, I hope you don't mind, there's some people staying at your house. They're 9 months pregnant, and they just showed up and said they knew you, and we just couldn't turn them away, so they're still there, and we didn't know when you were coming back. So we found them there, naked, having a picnic on the front porch, and very 9 months pregnant. And my brother-in-law turned around and said, I'm going back to town and staying with our friends in town. So my sister and I and the kids stayed there with them. And 2 days later, 2 mornings later, she went into labor, and I asked if she wanted a ride to town, and she said no. And I said, would you like me to call midwives or doctor or anything? No. And they had just been, you know, traveling and didn't have any insurance or any money. And I said, well, would you like me to stay home from work? And yes, could you? So I delivered a baby in the meadow a few hours later. And again, luckily she was healthy. There were some complications, and I ended up, actually the baby was eventually delivered fine. It took a while coming out. And I remember thinking, okay, I remember reading somewhere that it's okay if they're blue. They've got 7 minutes without oxygen before there's brain damage. And, you know, just trying to think, okay, don't panic. What, you know, what do we need to do here? And then eventually the baby was born and it was fine. But then the placenta didn't deliver. And I knew not to pull on the umbilical cord. I knew somebody almost died that way when the uterus, inverted and prolapsed. And so I knew not to do that. So I called Lynn Meadows, our midwife extraordinaire, on the first cell phone I'd ever seen. It was one of those huge clunky things that looked like it was from World War II or something. And it was radio phone, I guess. It wasn't really a cell phone. But anyway, I took it out in the meadow where we did the delivery, and I said, so can you tell me what to do here? And she described, oh, well, you hold on to the uterus. You know, you feel it from the stomach, you know, from outside. And then you can pull, you know, and it's still prolapsed. So they'll say, you just push it back in and then massage it till it feels like an orange. And so she kind of talked me through the whole process. And luckily she wasn't hemorrhaging or anything. I mean, if she'd been bleeding, we would have been out of there right away I knew that that was a danger sign, of course. But it turned out fine, and she didn't get an infection, and she didn't, you know, but she ended up just fine. And I think now I would, of course, know better than to try to do that. But at the time, I was like, okay, why not? La, 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 and let's just do this. And it worked. And we were more lucky than smart, I think. But it worked. And that little baby came to visit us a couple years ago. She was living in Humboldt County and doing really well and really great kid, as are most of them. You know, they're really wonderful people, all those kids that grew up together. And just last week we had a reunion, our second one, where people are, the little younger ones are bringing their little ones. So now we've got a little pack of grandkids running around and splashing in, you know, the tub and out in the common lawn and that kind of thing.
Can you talk about the stuff that the kids would do to amuse themselves? You already talked a little bit about your daughter making the musical instruments, but from your perspective, of course, being an adult, what was it like being a kid out there?
Well, we were in a very tiny house, so we didn't have much room for anything. We didn't, I remember we had one box of toys. That was it when they were growing up. So, of course, naturally, they tended to play outside. Lots of trees. And in the summer, we had apples and plums and pears to climb for, and walnuts in the fall. And so they did a lot of tree climbing. There was a creek, Robinson Creek. Actually, geographically, you can't get there from Robinson Creek Road, but geographically, it's at the headwaters of Robinson Creek. So they would play in the creek, and they had rocks that were different colors, and they would scrape them and make a mud, like a paste, clay, and paint their bodies. They had gray and brown and pink and yellow and kind of bluish, and they'd find all these different colors of rocks and clay and do these amazing body paintings. And often, of course, they would just do it with paint. We had some very creative body painting going on. There was one day when three of the girls painted themselves all over in matching patterns, so that each of them had like a little landscape on her chest and little circles on her bottom, and you know, and a necklace painted on. It was wonderful. And I'm not, who knows what they were doing. When the grass was tall and when the grass hadn't been cut in the common area, they'd make little tunnels and little houses, you know, tunnel through the 3 or 4 foot grass. I guess it seemed pretty tall to them. And I think they invented a game of crazy faces. Somebody gave them a little rubber stamp pad with noses and eyes and lips, and they had a whole game where you had to assemble the face as you went around the board. You got, you know, little face pieces, and they just made all the pieces. I think we might even still have it around here somewhere. So they didn't seem to ever run out of ideas.
Did you have any memorable encounters with wildlife?
Well, I do remember the people across the driveway, our neighbors and land partners, tended to be kind of noisy. They had several boys and a lot of construction and other projects going on. And one Sunday morning, there was a lot of banging going on. And I was kind of teasing the mother later. I said, "What were those guys up to at 6 o'clock on a Sunday morning?" She said, "Oh, that wasn't them. It was a bear tearing apart our chicken house." So they had chickens in a house with a yard, you know, a fenced in yard attached to it. But the bear just ripped off the wall of the back of it. And we heard later that the bear was rounded up on someone else's property. But she said she went running out in her nightgown. She thought, didn't know what was going on out there, and came face to face with a bear and had to turn around and run back. We also had turkeys visiting us. And for a while, it was just the females. And the kids were very fond of them and named them and were petting them, and they were very friendly with the females. And then one day a tom showed up, and I don't know much about turkey lifestyle, so I'm not sure what the story was there, but suddenly we had a tom turkey, and he was very possessive. And geese will do that too. We used to have geese in Powder Valley, and I noticed the same thing. The females were fine and friendly, and the male had different ideas, like stay away from my women. So we have a picture of him pecking at his reflection in our window. It was a kind of a low, dead to the ground window, and he thought it was another turkey, and he's getting all ruffled, literally ruffled, you know, the big tail sticking up and everything turning red on his head, the waddles. And he wouldn't let the kids near the females after that. They had to just stay out of the way. In fact, I remember one of them climbing a rock to get away from him, because they can be pretty aggressive. And of course, lots of other wildlife. there was the time the kids said, I was in the kitchen and they said, there's a snake in the tree. And I thought, yeah, right, snake in the tree. Well, the madrone trees, probably because the oaks and firs were shading them when they were young. There's one of them growing at a 45 degree angle and a pretty sturdy, healthy, mature tree, but at an angle. And there was a scrub jay nest up a ways up the tree, probably 10 or 15 feet off of the ground and maybe 20 feet along the trunk of the madrone. And this rattlesnake, a pretty large rattlesnake, had slithered up the madrone tree to the nest and was eating one of the baby birds, which is kind of adolescent, I think. It was a pretty good size, but it didn't have much in the way of feathers. And it was half stuffed into the snake's mouth. And the parents and the aunts and uncles or whoever were dive bombing it. You know, Jay's going crazy. Everybody knows what that sounds like. But they were really upset and diving at the snake. And we're just watching, thinking, how is the snake going to deal with this? Is it going to try to slither down with that thing in its mouth or try to eat it in place? Because it looked like it was pretty stuck in its mouth. Well, the snake decided to just drop, and it dropped probably 10 or 15 feet onto the ground below and just kind of lay there wondering probably what it had gotten itself into. But I realized that it wasn't about to bite anybody with that bird jammed in its mouth. So I took a couple pictures and then carried it to another part of the property where I just, you know, let it go and finish its lunch. And I've never seen anything like that before or since.
So what kinds of relationships did you have with people outside the community? Were the people who are already here fairly friendly to you, or were there some schisms between the back to the landers and the older families?
It was a mix. I think most of the people who lived in that neighborhood were couples, like the baby boomer parents, the couples who married after World War II. And old Knox Cardwell at the end of our road, which is named after him, Knoxville Road, not our road, but our, you know, stone's throw drive comes off Knoxville, was very wonderful and helpful. And he would come and winch us out of the mud, you know, if we hadn't been putting gravel on the driveway, and just give us, you know, wisdom and just help with whatever needed help. Another woman up the hill didn't want us walking on her land, and she was mad because they used to dump garbage down the hill onto our property, and we asked them to stop doing that. And she said, well, we've been doing it for a long time, so we should be able to keep doing it. But it was going right into the creek, and it just didn't seem like a good idea. So they did stop, but they kind of resented it. Other people, there was another old couple that the Grandpa Dory, they said he never went to town in 20 years or something. I'm not sure what the detail was. They actually lived almost halfway to town from where our land was. But one day, more than once, the kids went and visited him with somebody brought them to visit. And they just really had a nice time and a nice visit. So it was a, you know, mixed bag. Mostly we got along fine. I'm sure some of the neighbors were a little nervous about this property suddenly being populated by, at one time, 10 houses. We tore down some of the funkier handmade ones, but we ended up with 6 permanent dwellings, which eventually got legalized when all that was happening in the mid-80s. When we first moved there, we were paying very cheap rent. I think it was $600 a month in 1981 to rent 68 acres with 10 houses on it. And each of us was paying $100 a month, or, you know, and some of that was, it was more than we even needed for the rent, so some of it went for maintenance stuff. And then 2 years later, the owner, who thought that he was going to retire there, and that's why he had been renting it out all those years, and then he realized, yeah, I'm not going to retire there. He told us he wanted to sell it, and we said, wait, don't sell it. Yeah, we're going to try to buy it, see what we can do. And all of us had more or less chosen to be there, partly because of the low overhead lifestyle. We weren't expecting to have to come up with a big balloon payment, and we had an agreement not to grow marijuana, especially in the 80s. It was just a really touchy business. They were threatening to take people's land away, and people had gone to jail. And with, you know, kids, we thought, we don't want to go there. We just don't want to bring that energy here. So we weren't doing that. And we just, you know, borrowed from family or did what we could, sold things or worked or whatever. I borrowed money from some of my neighbors and eventually paid them back after we had paid off the land, and we had a, I think it was 5 years mortgage and then a balloon payment. And it seemed like a lot at the time, but I don't think you can get land for that price anymore.
What about the efforts at legalizing? It sounds like this was post-Class K. So what was that experience like?
The timing for us was really perfect because we were buying the land and finishing the paperwork. We incorporated as a corporation to buy the place in July of 1986. And it was just during that window, there was a six-month amnesty window, when the county said, turn yourself in and we'll give you a deal. You know, we'll make it easier on you and we'll allow you to have, for instance, composting privies and that kind of thing. And it doesn't have to be totally up to code. And the what they had at that time was called Blur 2, which we thought was a funny name, Basic Land Use Reform Act, I think it was, where they, it wasn't Class K, but it was basically the same idea. And I'm not sure what the politics were that behind that, whatever happened to Class K, but that was what we had at that time. And it seemed pretty huge. We had to go through the zoning administrator because we were over density. It was zoned for one house per 40 acres. And we basically only had permission for one house. And we had six at that time. We, you know, some people said, forget it, I can't afford to buy in, or I'm not that committed. And you know, some of the single people on the fringes of the property left, or it would be too much trouble to legalize the house. So some people left and one came and joined us, so that we had the six families that are now the core community. And we went through the health department, and we had to, you know, they were concerned about privies and vector proofing and that kind of thing, and the water system, of course, and told us to put chlorine in the wonderful spring water. It's just some of the best water anywhere, with or without chlorine. We did it to pass the test anyway. And the building department, of course, which gave us 24 pages, I think, of lists of things to do to the houses. And I was kind of pissed off because I had a leaky roof and no hot water and no electricity, and I wanted it to be more livable with utilities and that kind of thing for little kids. My neighbors were very generous about letting me use their bathtub, but I wanted my own bathtub. And the county didn't care about any of that. They didn't care if the roof leaked. They didn't care if there was no electricity. That actually simplified their job. They just wanted, oh, railings on the deck, if it was more than 18-inch drop or whatever it was, and railings on the stairways and the loft, and clearance from wood pipe to the ceiling, and it had to be so, you know, so much taller than the roof. And it seemed to me it was working fine, but I guess it is safer that way with an insulated pipe and spacing from the wood and wood earth clearance. I know, I understand now this is all, you know, a good idea, but at the time I was like, who cares? I just want hot water and the roof not to leak. But we did it. It took 2 years, and we had work parties, and we had consultants, and we had a couple of people, even people who had worked on places at Greenfield had already started going through this kind of thing. So, and I remember talking about my house and saying, well, it's just a little handmade wood house, and should I be concerned about earthquakes? Is it worth putting all this into if it's just going to get knocked over? And I think it was Lang Russell who said, you know what, wood houses don't really fall over in earthquakes. They're kind of nailed together so that if anything, they'll just slump. I don't know if that's really true or if it would have been true in my case, but it made me feel much better. I was like, okay, it's not going to collapse on us in the middle of the night. That's nice. So, yeah, it took quite a lot. It took 2 years. They gave us, I think, 2 years or roughly that amount of time to get all the work done. And boy, did we ever have lists, you know, pages of stuff that needed to be done. Again, most of which I didn't care about. I wanted to develop the garden. I was growing a lot of vegetables. I walked past the produce aisle the whole time I lived there. We just grew our own food. And I had my priorities, but those couple of years were pretty intense. And it certainly couldn't have happened without a lot of people helping and working on each other's houses and working together on, you know, roads and water systems and things like that.
Why did you leave?
Well, who knew those kids were going to turn into teenagers? I guess I hadn't really thought it through, or I guess I just assumed that we'd always be there until I had grandkids, you know, rock around the porch kind of thing. But when the kids are teenagers, we all discovered that actually it was like dominoes one after another. We ended up moving into town because they just really don't want to play and paint their bodies with clay anymore and climb trees. You know, they really want to do the social things. They had the dance classes and theater things and sports and whatever else they were doing. And they really needed to be in town more. So I was, by that time, I was working practically 5 days a week, I think. And we did a lot of driving. And it just, I remember sitting there one day after dinner and looking up at the skylights over the kitchen table and seeing a bunch of cobwebs and thinking, you know, I don't live here anymore. I'm not even here often enough to clean out the cobwebs. We come home and then start the fire and make dinner and go to bed and wake up, make the fire, have breakfast and leave. And it was very sad. It was very difficult. I tried, and it took me a couple of years to admit it and, you know, actually decide to do it. During that time, I rented a room in a friend's house in town, two different friends' houses. We tried this and we tried that, but that was like moving twice a week, you know. Do you have your dance clothes? Do you have your school books? Do you have your homework? Have we got our groceries? Have we got our laundry? You know, it was just more than it was worth dealing with because they just needed to be in town, as I said. So we moved to town.
Was so little and fine. It's sweet and it's good and it's mine. They hadn't been sweeping the leaves off the porch. I'd care for it better, I'd keep it all neat. It's mine and it's good and sweet. There's a loft and skylights and windows galore. The spaces are open with beautiful wood. It's sweet and it's mine and it's good.
We've been listening to a lightly edited interview with Mary Buckley as part of Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. That song at the end is an original tune by Mary Buckley. This program airs on KZYX at 3:30 on Thursday afternoons. You can also catch shorter excerpts during the news hour on Thursday mornings at 7:45 and 8:45, and again at 6 p.m. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.